The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Alceu Maurício. I'm a federal judge from Brazil. And this year, I'm here for the Humphrey Fellowship Program. The Humphrey Fellowship Program is an exchange program sponsored by the U.S. Department of State. And I'm here for broaden my knowledge in human rights and make some network with my counterparts in the United States. But here today, I'll be moderating this panel. And when you're talking about human rights, this panel is embraces a very important group of people devoted to the protection and human rights, and also the rule of law. Well, we have the opportunity here to learn a little bit from the experience from many people. Mrs. Julissa Reynoso Simpson from the Simpson, Toucher and Bartlett law firm. Dean Claudio Grossman from the Washington College of Law, Jose Quiñones from the BlueLatinos.org, Mr. Santiago Canton from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and Mrs. Vanessa Jimenez from the Public International Law and Policy Group Organization. Oh. We'll first have a Mrs. Julissa Reynoso. She is an attorney in New York City at the firm of Simpson, Toucher and Bartlett. She is an active in various community international projects on social rights. And please, Mrs. Julissa Reynoso.
¿Cuánto tiempo tenemos para hablar?
10 minutes.
Okay. All right, folks. Well, I apologize for walking a little late. I was outside gossiping. I concerning the issue at hand, I have 10 minutes to tell you all about how Latinos are affecting the global political environment. There are a couple of things I want to talk about, and I want you to kind of take it as it is. I am an attorney. I also am a fellow at Columbia University School of Law. The primary interest of my work has been in the area of organizing, community organizing, and its impact on regulatory changes. What does this have to do with the topic at hand, which is Latinos in the global political environment? I think one of the things that we have to seriously consider as a community here in the United States, a very impoverished community and a marginalized community, which is by far the vast majority of us, is to re-examine what we consider power, and how power is generated, and how power is maintained, and how power is used. So I honestly think that we are using very antiquated models of acquisition of power, and copying models of power that have proven to be ineffective, and I believe will be ineffective for us because we are truly poor people. What does this mean in terms of active, and what does it mean in terms of action? I think that going forward, we have to imagine a mobilizing effort whereby we as people of color, and Latinos in particular, are willing and able to learn and engage with people who in the past were considered not as educated as we elected, chosen affirmative action few that have been allowed to enter these universities. So that means that we are going to have to affirmatively progress with the communities that many of us left behind, meaning the ghettos, meaning our families, meaning our poor neighbors. I'm from the South Bronx, so my people in the South Bronx, and folks in those types of communities that are seen as not having knowledge, not having information, and not having experiences, or not having power for us to actually take from them and learn from them and move with them to influence change. And that is a very abstract way of saying that in order for us Latinos to exercise power in the global environment, we have to start at the very, very, very local level, and meaning at the street level, meaning at the level of actually engaging with people like us who are disenfranchised, and meaning getting a reality check for some of us who are in the upper echelons of law firms and academia and the like, that we do not have all the answers, and that the answers lie in within the circles of people who we are supposed to be, where we come from, and who are involved in the daily struggle that we talk so much about. So what does that mean in terms of taking those knowledge, that's not even a phrase, those lessons learned and moving forward into the global ambience? I think taking those lessons learned and using that power to exercise our leverage as people in the most important and I'm not even going to say learn it, but certainly the most apparently or self-categorized learned country in the universe, we have to use those lessons learned from the streets and mobilize that information to create a system of change that is new and that can influence the way this country exercises development, exercises understanding to other people, especially other marginalized people that in certain parts of the world look a lot like us. So that's my little spiel about how Latinos can, if we're willing to take the chance of trying to reinvent power, can influence the world. Thank you.
Now we're going to hear Mr. Dean Claudio Grossman. Dean Claudio Grossman is the Dean of Washington College of Law, but among many other activities, I would like to highlight he's also the Vice Chairman and member of United Nations Committee Against Torture, and also an Executive Board member of the Inter-American Institute of Human Rights. He's also a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Was a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and representing the commission, he has participated in many missions to Haiti, Brazil, and Mexico, Canada, and other countries. Even I think some months ago we were in Brazil.
And that was for the Committee Against Torture, not for the Inter-American Commission.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Dean.
Thank you for the introduction. Let me see. The question Latinos in the global political environment has many dimensions, and one is what you can do in the global political environment, and what opportunities are for you there. I mean, let me tell you something, to go into that direction. I am a member of the United Nations Committee Against Torture. There are 139 countries that have ratified the Convention Against Torture, and these 139 countries elect 10 people who supervise compliance with that convention. The United Nations has bodies that supervise compliance with human rights. Some of these bodies are treaty bodies, like the Committee Against Torture. And other bodies are charter bodies created by the Charter of the United Nations, like the United Nations ECOSOC. I mean, so you have special treaties like the Convention Against Torture, the Convention to Protect Women, and so forth, the provision of racial discrimination. And all these conventions have supervisory mechanisms, whose goal is promote and protect rights within the sphere of the competence. These supervisory organs do different things. For example, the Committee Against Torture can hear cases, but only concerning countries that have accepted the committee's jurisdiction. The U.S. has not accepted the committee's jurisdiction. Most of the European countries have, and some Latin American countries also, like Chile. In addition, the committee receives reports once every 4 years. And these reports are presented before the 10 members, and these reports are analyzed by the members. There is also a public hearing, comments, questions, and then the committee issues observations and recommendations. And these things matter. For the government, it's not good if the public opinion on the basis of a legitimate treaty organ like the Committee Against Torture would conclude that they are torturers. Okay? So that's something that it has some power in international law. You know, we don't have a judiciary. We have the International Court of Justice, but it's not the same as the domestic judiciary. So we have these indirect ways, committee reports, appealing to a public opinion, but all these things matter. I mean, the countries defend themselves. They fight for the fight of public opinion. Now, the third thing that we do is we visit countries. We go to countries on confidential procedures when we have when we think that there is systematic torture, for example. I mean, to go to a country, we need authorization. Now, what can you do as individuals on this type of things? And first of all, there are internships of the United Nations. And you can go into the website, there is a system of internships, you can apply for those, and so forth and so on. Also, non-governmental organizations participate in the committee's work because we have public hearings. We don't get only information from from the countries. So Amnesty International, the International Commission of Juries, the Watch Committees, and so forth, all the vast panoply of NGOs appear before the committee. And some of these NGOs bring also interns. Now, you're asking yourself, well, and what is the Latino connection here? Huh? Well, the first thing is the following, that is important to know. There is hardly an issue in today's world that is purely domestic. All the matters have an international connection. And if you're going to be lawyers, you want to know, I mean, what are the possibilities in international law? Many things happen, you know, when we take a case, make a comment, do certain things on women issues, racial discrimination under the Convention Against Discrimination, issues involving torture, and so forth and so on. So knowing that the way to transform things is not any longer limited to one national unit is important. I mean, you know, you need to know what are the avenues, the ways, and the possibilities that are offered. Even the distinction between things that are purely domestic and purely international is not any longer tenable. Mm-hmm. If we want to have a better environment, it's not enough to say, well, we will adopt environmental measures if the neighbors are doing something. I mean, it's going to affect that. In terms of trade, I mean, and not only in the good things, we're more exposed in the world because of terrorism, illness, and so forth. This would not have happened in the classic world of international law, where we have units living as if it were within. Now we live in a different world. One example for that, in U.S. Legal education, we hardly had the programs abroad. Now, our law schools have more than 200 summer programs abroad. In this school, in addition to that, we have semester programs abroad. We have dual JD programs with Spain, France, and Canada. You know, you can be 2 years here and 2 years in Spain and get the 2 degrees. We have international exchange. I mean, all the law schools are developing this. And then if you want to be someone defending the interests of the community, of a client, and so forth, you need to open yourself to a new world reality where the distinction between domestic and international is not any longer tenable, because everything is interconnected and interrelated. And if we don't blow up the planet or someone else doesn't do it, this process most likely will continue. And it's going to get more and more, you know, it's going to be achieving higher elements. I mean, you get into any classroom here, you have people with computers playing Nintendo or other things, and so on. But also emailing to people all over the world. I mean, in one of these rooms, you know, we have high technology. We had the film, you know, on, and we saw the students doing all types of things except listening to a fact. But I'm sure you laugh because you recognize this. You know. But imagine what was the landscape of law schools 20 years ago, 10 years ago. The space, the pace of change is unbelievable. So if you are, you know, I'm going to be only domestic lawyer, that doesn't exist anymore. Other important thing. Language knowledge and the Hispanic tradition. I mean, being an Hispano, an Hispana, gives you a tremendous competitive edge in the world. Many things happen because of the ability to see things, understand things, and the knowledge of culture and language is important. Huh? Some of us were not born Japanese American, African American, or what do I know? We, you know, or you are born in a certain tradition with a certain language. Better you assume it and develop it, because it's a very important tradition. Spanish is a very important language. It's a UN language. You know, in the Committee Against Torture, and everything is Spanish, English, French. So the Spanish is important. You have access to things. So, so I encourage you to learn about these possibilities. I talk a little bit. I see he's getting very nervous here about time, and you know, I want to respect that. Did I talk already for 10 minutes? So I have a couple of minutes more. But I will say, try to get an externship. Develop your language skills, Spanish, Portuguese, and your knowledge of your background and culture, because that provides you with insights that other people were not as lucky as you were to have. The trade, I mean, I've talked about human rights, the trade between Latin America and the United States is larger than the combined trade of the United States with Europe and Japan. If you are interested in trade matters, you can do a lot also there. Now, in the ambience of the United Nations, in the committee of, you know, there are two Spanish speakers, for example, out of 10, 20%. The other one is a member from Ecuador, a good friend from Santiago Cantón, who was also in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. You see, with the Spanish and the Spanish culture, you can learn a lot. Now, I think that the most important thing is to understand the new world reality. I don't believe, for example, that it's possible just to have progress in one country. And I think there is consensus here, whatever is the political perspective. Up to September 11, 2001, probably there was some type of deal with Saudi Arabia. For example, you sell us oil and you can do anything you want internally. Well, if you can do anything that you want internally, that means also financing madrasas or, you know, and 15 of the people who came to this country and blew up, you know, committed this horrendous act of terrorism were from Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia. Don't we have an interest in the promotion of women's rights, human rights, and democracy? Huh? We do, because everything is interconnected in the past. Now, do things that happen in other countries of the world have an impact in us? Sure, take a look what happened here. This is not necessarily good news. It's news. Whether it's good or bad depends where you are. But there is new. So we cannot escape the world and think that we can achieve security, a good environment, or the development of the Hispanic community in the United States to its full extent in a world where there is deprivation or poverty or problems of human rights. So from that perspective, knowledge of the world is crucial and essential. And those who have an Hispanic heritage and know Spanish or Portuguese are well suited to turn that into a tremendous advantage. There are 35 countries in this region, Spanish speakers, Portuguese speakers, one country speaks Dutch, Suriname, and French, Haiti, but with Spanish and Portuguese you have access to a tremendous world and so forth. Put it to its full advantage. It's not going to be something only for you. It's also, I would suggest, important for the Hispanic community and for the country and the world at large. Thank you for your attention.
Now, Mr. Jose Quiñones. Mr. Jose Quiñones is the BlueLatinos.org founder, and he also worked for MoveOnPAC.org during 2004 presidential elections. He was also a senior policy analyst at the Center for Community Change in Washington, D.C.
Thank you for that introduction, and you know, it's a pleasure to be in this panel today. You know, but before I begin my comments, I want to invite everyone here, you know, to visit and join BlueLatinos.org. You know, in just 6 months of starting BlueLatinos.org, over 9,000 progressive Latinos have actually joined the organization, and we have taken political action together. The Blue and BlueLatinos.org, in case you're wondering, comes from the idea of the blue states versus red states, you know, that reflect the political divide between progressives and conservatives in the United States today. I mean, we're blue because we're progressive, not red, not conservative. So, you know, with no grants, you know, no corporate donations or no political money except that from our own, you know, own pockets, we are using today's technology to empower and realize our vision of America. So next time you're in front of the computer, and some of you guys already are in front of your computers, please make sure to visit BlueLatinos.org and join. So now that I have that, you know, have that covered, let me start my comments by addressing this one question. You know, what am I doing on this panel? I asked myself that question quite a bit in the past couple of days because it's pretty, you know, illustrious panel that's supposed to address Latinos in the global political environment, right? Well, what does a blue Latino have to do with global politics? It's a very good question. And I'm really here to illustrate how you as a U.S. Latino can engage in the global political arena by using a new understanding of who we are. Really, my purpose is to challenge us to think of the Latino community as a vibrant and dynamic transnational communities who naturally fit in the global context of today. So my presentation, I want to explore how that transnational framework can really help bridge the responsibilities to our local communities while, you know, walking here, while at the same time further our interests and expand our roles in the global arena. So I have, you know, really three main parts of my presentation, and one is to explain the transnational framework, and then two, to illustrate how I've used this theory to further my work with BlueLatinos.org, and also to explore how, you know, to explore how you can further this vision within your particular work. You know, I was fortunate enough to have studied under Alejandro Portes. He's a sociology professor at Princeton University while I was completing my master's degree at the Woodrow Wilson School. Professor Portes has been instrumental in developing this theoretical framework of transnational communities and a driving force in developing a whole new field of research really, you know, worldwide, because there's a lot that we need to learn from who he calls global villagers. So I want to explain the concept of transnational communities really by telling you a story, a very well-known story at this point in the current literature, and the story reads, when a farming community, you know, in the Mixteca region of Mexico wanted a clean water supply, you know, they turned to a private civic group called the Tijuana Potable Water Committee. And as they had it many times before, the committee delivered. It quickly raised about $50,000, mostly in $100 donations to purchase and install new tubing and to bring clean water to Tijuana. At first glance, this seems like an unremarkable story of civic participation. I mean, the water committee, however, wasn't in Tijuana, nor even in Mexico. It was in Brooklyn, New York. The committee didn't just send the money, they were directly involved. After learning that the tubes had arrived, the committee members flew from JFK Airport on a Friday, conferred with contractors and authorities over the weekend, and returned in time for work Monday morning. This story was really reported back in 1992 by Robert F. Smith, in a study of hometown associations. You know, since then, the number of hometown associations, particularly of Mexicans living in the United States, has grown to over 2,000. Indeed, hometown associations have become the real-life manifestations of how immigrant workers have responded to the process of globalization. They've created communities that have span political borders, that in real sense are neither here nor there, but at once here and there. So thus the transnational frame essentially does away with the simple notion that Latinos are just an ethnic minority tied to specific localities with no interests beyond the east sides of town. The transnational frame allows us to see what's really going on in the Latino communities today. You know, we can see that Latino communities are involved, indeed involved, civic-minded, responsible, and acting together in their own terms to move their own agendas forward, an agenda that is both international and local at the same time. The Taquani Hometown Association thus illustrates the very essence of what it means to be a global actor today. And this is how I try to put that theory to practice. I saw a perfect match, really, between this idea of transnational communities and virtual communities. Why? Because they both do not rely on location, but rather they rely on ideas, shared values, and information that leads towards action. Empowered by this understanding, I started BlueLatinos.org with a purpose to facilitate the civic involvement of progressive Latinos and to channel that energy that was already there towards progressive action. I mean, since starting the organization, I send out a number of emails, and I think some of you have received them, right? And after today, I want all of you guys to receive them. Number of emails really regarding petitions from, you know, getting a petition to fire CNN's Lou Dobbs for his anti-immigrant, you know, hysteria, and also to get Urban Outfitters to remove offensive T-shirts, to actually asking President Bush to stop, you know, scapegoating immigrants. I've done that to address the issues that we know that are concerned to us here domestically, but I've also sent out emails and started campaigns regarding, you know, Latin America. Last month, I sent out an email entitled Latin America Matters, Elections Matter, to help to provide a service to Latinos to provide them information about the upcoming elections throughout Latin America. Because in this election cycle, in the 2005-2006 election cycle, about 23 or 22 countries are going to be electing new presidents and legislatures, you know, in Latin American countries. And these are elections that matter to us as Latinos in the United States. And why does it matter? Well, because now about half of the Latin American countries actually allow for dual citizenship. So that we have a lot of immigrants in this country that actually have dual citizenship, they care about what's happening in Latin America, so we need to then provide them information regarding those elections. Even to the point that four countries allow for citizens living abroad to actually vote on these elections. Most recently, Mexico joined this group of four that are now going to be allowing Mexicans living here to vote on the next presidential election on July 2nd. The other three are Colombia, Dominica.
Not allowed or will allow?
They will allow.
Yeah, you said you would not allow.
Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. They will allow. Mexico will allow. Thank you for catching that.
No, come on. I know it's very important.
Yeah, exactly. It's important because, you know, this group of four, Colombia, Dominican Republic, Honduras, and Mexico, you know, is going to grow in the years to come if this exercise of allowing Latinos living abroad have actually participated in the election. So. I also, you know, in that regard, I started a new service as well called Manda Tu Voto, a service to help Mexican, you know, citizens living here to inform them about this process of registering, you know, for this election and actually encourage them to participate in the election. And I have, you know, quite a series of different activities planned through this Manda Tu Voto campaign. They estimate that about 4 million Mexicans living in the United States are going to be able to participate in these elections, but it's going to be very critical to actually get them the right information at the right time so that they can actually exercise their right to vote. These are just then, you know, really a few examples of how BlueLatinos.org, you know, how really I'm trying to bridge our responsibilities to our local communities here while at the same time furthering our interest and expanding our role in the global arena. Because there is much, much more we need to do, and there's much, much more we should be doing. But I think it starts from the right framework of understanding, you know, who it is that we're dealing with. So, you know, with that, I want to leave you then with three ideas for how you can use this transnational framework, you know, to your work and to further your studies. So one, I want you guys to learn to see Latino communities in a new light, based on the realities of today, not through antiquated notions or idealistic ideas of what we were or could have been. Second, expand your vision and sense of identity to include a wider hemispheric sense of yourself. And third, I want to ask you to engage in your school's publications, your law journals and such, and write about the challenges and opportunities to transnational communities. This is a field of research that is new and vast, and I think you can add, you know, you can significantly add to this area of study. I truly believe that, you know, by taking these steps, you know, guided by the right vision and understanding of who we are, you as law students can help unlock our collective passion and talents that will significantly expand Latinos' roles in the global arena. And I want to leave you with one last thought, and that is this. You know, in a way, we, the educated so-called leaders of the Latino community, really have to play catch-up to the migrant workers who are building the human bonds that have tied, or that are tying the Americas together. Indeed, migrant workers, in my view, are like the mighty Atlas, who are the ones that are holding our world on their shoulders. So, you know, with those thoughts, I wanted to frame how it is possible that us as U.S. Latinos can then be more engaged in the global context today. So again, I want to thank you for allowing me to speak with you today, and I welcome any questions or comments afterwards.
Now, Mr. Santiago Cantón, he's from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and he was previously the Organization of American States Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression. And he was also the Director of Public Information for the OAS, and also the Director for Latin American and Caribbean of the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs.
Thank you very much. After the previous presentations, it's hard to figure out exactly what will be the best presentation I can make or what will be the best topic that you all will be more interested in. But let me refer first to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is the topic that I was asked to make a presentation today, and then I will give my 5 cents to the topic that is being discussed, particularly in the last presentation. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights. The Inter-American Commission, many of you might not know about, is a body that is part of the Organization of American States, the OAS, which the OAS is made by 35 states of the Americas. That goes from Canada to Argentina, going through all the Caribbean. So 35 member states and 34 governments. Why? Because the government of Cuba is not part of the OAS, but the state of Cuba is part of the OAS. So there are 35 states and 34 governments. The government of Cuba was suspended back in 1961. Part of the OAS, there is the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights and the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. The Inter-American Commission is made by 7 members. Dean Grossman was a member of the commission a couple of years ago, and he was 2 years, he was the president of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. So it's made by 7 members. The members are elected by the states. Every 2 years, they elect new members. And they do not represent the states, the governments of the states they're coming from. Mr. Grossman is a citizen of Chile, and he did not represent Chile. He represents the rights of the individuals of the Americas. So they are in that position in their individual capacity, not as representative of the states. So there is this 7-member body, and there is another 7-member body, which is the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which is based in San Jose, Costa Rica. How does the system work? Every person in the Americas can present a complaint to the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights. Currently, we have approximately 1,300 complaints. Every person can present a complaint to us based on the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights or the Inter-American Declaration of Human Rights, which is our code, and we process the complaints. So we process the complaints. Currently, precisely at this very moment, there is a sessions of the commission in which the seven members get together here in Washington for 3 weeks, and they discuss the petitions that we received. They sit down and they analyze the cases, they look into the violations, and they decide whether or not there has been a violation of human rights. If this seven-member body finds out that there has been a violation of human rights of the individual presented the complaint, we send a series of recommendations to the government to repair those violations. Typical case, cases of torture, cases of police brutality, cases of disappearances, cases of extrajudicial executions. So they come to the commission analyzes the cases, the commissions have hearings, the state comes to the commission, they defend themselves, the petitioners come to the commission to argue against the government, and once the commission makes a decision, we send that decision to the government. The government might decide not to comply with our recommendation. In such a case, if that's the situation, we send the case to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights based in San Jose de Costa Rica, and there starts another process like in any court between the government and the petitioners. So that's in very, very natural how does the Inter-American system for the protection of human rights work. Important to say now is the impact the Inter-American system has had over the last decades on improving the situation of human rights in the Americas. Which has not resolved individual cases. The decisions made by the Commission have an impact all over the countries. In the case of, for instance, recently the government of Chile changed the constitution of Chile, and the constitution passed during the years of Pinochet had a Senate formed by individuals. Not selected by the people, they were just in the category they were representing different sectors of society, representing the church, representing the military. So there was a decision of the commission that constitution was against the Convention of Human Rights. Therefore, we asked the government of Chile to reform the constitution, and the government of Chile finally changed the constitution to ban those articles of the constitution. In cases in Guatemala, there was a civil code in Guatemala that did not allow for the women to work without the approval of their husbands. And that was just a few years ago. Through a case in the commission, the government of Guatemala had to change the civil code, and they did. There was Argentina had defamation laws in their criminal code and civil code. Again, through a case in the commission, Argentina changed the code. So through the Inter-American Commission, we have made important changes. I mentioned that Canada, U.S., and all the Caribbean countries also are part of the Inter-American system. Unfortunately, not all the countries comply with the recommendations of the Inter-American system. The U.S. has difficulty to comply with the recommendation of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. However, we have some made progress, specifically in recent years, for instance, in the case of Guantanamo. The commission asked the government of the U.S. to inform what was the legal status of the people detained in Guantanamo, and the government of the U.S. came to the commission. They said that the position of the government was that we had no jurisdiction on the topic, but in any case, the same petitioners that came to the commission represented the first case that reached the U.S. Supreme Court regarding the Guantanamo case, and while arguing in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, they used the decision of the commission regarding the right of the individuals to have a due process. So we've been making some important progress also, not only in Latin America, which the commission has a history of more than 40 years of improving the situation of human rights, but also U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean. Now, let me just add one. I hope I have a couple of more minutes. A couple of other ideas. A few years ago, with Raúl Izaguirre, who was the head of the National Council of La Raza, and a few other Latinos in the U.S., we thought about the idea of creating the what later became to be the Hispanic Council of International Relations, HCIR. The idea was to find ways in which the Latinos community in the U.S. that was not probably, as it was mentioned before, were not taking advantage of the power the Latino community in the U.S. really could have. So we, the HCIR was created, and the issue became, which is something that was reflected in this panel, the power the Latino community can have to influence politics in the U.S. on the one hand, but also how the power the Latino community could have in influence politics not only in the U.S., but mainly in Latin America as well. And that is an issue that I believe still needs to be more developed, which while on the one hand there is a big understanding there is an understanding of the importance of developing the power of the Latino community in the U.S. to influence politics in the U.S., there's not much what Jose mentioned about using the power of the Latino community in the U.S. to influence politics in Latin America. And that's something, obviously, we are not going to hear from the panel tell you what you should do or not do. But definitely there is an importance of having the Latino community in the U.S. looking into Latin America, who are not all, but many of the Latinos come from, or most of the Latinos come from, and try to influence politics in those countries. And why? The question is why. Again, we are not going to be, at least myself, is not going to tell you what you should do or not do. But if you look at Latin America, here is a region with 43% of the population that lives under the poverty line. Here you have a region that one out of four women suffer domestic violence in Latin America. Here you have a region with the largest difference in income distribution in the world, the largest inequality of income distribution in the world. Here you have a region in which we were in South America, in the Southern Cone, a couple of decades ago. Thousand and thousand and thousand, we are talking about 15 or 30,000 people in Argentina disappear, 3,000 people in Chile disappear, hundreds of thousands of people killed by conflicts, internal conflicts in Central America. So here, basically, if you start to add up, unfortunately, over the last decades, millions of people have been killed because of different internal conflicts. So definitely, here is a region that will benefit from the influence the Latino community in the U.S. Can exert over all these people, millions of people in all these countries, and that has not been done yet, I believe. And this is a challenge that all Latinos in the U.S. still have, and hopefully in the next years we'll see an improvement in this area as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Santiago Cantón. Now, Mrs. Vanessa Jimenez, she's been working and studying in the last 13 years in the field of international law and human rights, and now she's working the Public International Law and Policy Group in the preparation of several publications regarding the drafting of post-conflict constitutions and peace agreements. I'd like to highlight that the Public International Law and Policy Group is working in the draft of the Iraq Constitution, and it has been also nominated to the Nobel Peace Prize for previous works on Bosnia and Kosovo.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and sorry, I'm the last speaker. You're all probably a little tired. You need that stretch. Please feel free to do so. I'm very happy to be here. And like another colleague has mentioned, I'm not sure why I'm on this most illustrious panel as well. It really is an honor to be here with all of you, especially with the Honorable Cantón. You know, my contact mostly with him has been through clients that I've had before the Inter-American Commission, and writing letters to him to share some space here is quite an honor, and as well as Dean Claudio Grossman, who I am an alumni of this institution. I graduated here 8 years ago, and Dean Claudio Grossman and his admission staff took quite a chance on me. Between you and me and the camera, I didn't do very well in the LSATs, but just despite those LSAT people and to prove myself, I did graduate at the top of my class, and since then I've been trying very hard to live up to the standards of this institution and the chance that they gave me to be here. I find it very one of the things I thought about when I was asked to be on this panel was the fact that, you know, this Latinos in the global community, as a Latina, what am I doing? I recall that really until about the age of 18, my name wasn't Vanessa Jimenez. It was actually Vanessa Jimenez, without the accent over the E. My father, Puerto Rican, came over from Puerto Rico, at some point decided that in the community that we lived in when he came over, because of experiences he had, that my sisters and I would all have a much nicer life if we use the hard J. So we all have hard, you know, middle initials that are all hard J's. It wasn't until I was about 18 that I sort of really, I mean, I always had my culture, I always had my family, I always knew where I came from, but there was this aspect of my name that was very important to me, and I changed it when I was about 18. And I do recall that one very proud day when I was in one of my first jobs after college in the Americas division at Human Rights Watch. I was so happy to be working there. And I was told that I got a phone call, and a gentleman called the office, and the receptionist, you know, picked it up, and he said, "Yes, I'd like to speak to Vanessa Jimenez." And the receptionist, you know, very proudly and politically correctly said, "Well, we don't have a Vanessa Jimenez here, but we do have a Vanessa Jimenez." He said, "Well, whatever you call her, just tell her father's on the phone. I'd like to speak to her." So I am Vanessa Jimenez now, and I've always been a Latina, but so I've come a little bit of a way. I understood that sort of my job here was to kind of just give you a flavor of some of the things that I've been doing since I graduated law school, just to give you a sense of when we talk about Latinos in the global political environment, all the different places that you can go, including in the Americas, including outside of the Americas, as Dean Claudia Grossman said, this is an international world, and what we do within the country, what we do within the Americas, what we do outside of the Americas all have impact, so regardless of where you are working. Since I've left law school, I mean, I've already told you I had a wonderful opportunity to work at the Americas Division in Human Rights Watch, and found a wonderful mentor there under Juan Mendez, who's currently this UN Special Rapporteur on Genocide. I've also, through my work at a nonprofit called Indian Law Resource Center, working on indigenous rights, I've had the wonderful experience to be able to go to Geneva and work at the UN and work with member states on the negotiation of a draft declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples, which would hopefully protect their sovereign rights to their lands, to their culture, to their education, to their language, to self-governance. And I was able to do the same thing at the OAS, at the Organization of American States, where they are also developing an international instrument, and to be able to work with indigenous peoples and member states on negotiating that draft. And it's in those contexts where I've also had, you know, the pleasure of listening to Executive Secretary Cantone encourage states to help forge this better relationship with indigenous peoples in a way so that the whole hemisphere could prosper from that relationship. I've also had the opportunity to work before the commission on cases advocating for the rights of indigenous peoples, where I've had the opportunity to run into Dean Claudio Grossman while he was at the commission. He sat on with respect to a case regarding the Augustinian community in Nicaragua, and while under his care and leadership, the commission and then eventually the Inter-American Court ruled on a very seminal decision for the hemisphere, saying that indigenous peoples do in fact have collective rights to their traditional lands and territory, and that really has set a ripple effect throughout the whole hemisphere regarding how we look at resource rights and self-governance and sovereignty and whatnot. So it was really wonderful. I've also had a remarkable experience to be able to be a lawyer for the Mohawks and the Senecas in New York, as you will probably know them as the Six Nations or the Iroquois Confederacy, in terms of their rights with respect to trying to get their land back and also to have people re-examine even our own U.S. Constitution and sort of the discriminatory provisions in those with respect to land, particularly how you and I can own land, and if the state, if the country takes it away from us, if the U.S. takes it away from us, we have a right to a hearing and due process. With respect to indigenous peoples here, the United States can unilaterally take those lands. And so I had those opportunities. I've also worked with international financial institutions with various colleagues around the world to try to open up these financial institutions to civil society and greater transparency and accountability, and get them to start rethinking about, you know, human rights-based development and what is the role of all these non-state actors in the development of human rights. And as you all know in your studies, that's a very large issue that's emerging as people talk about just trade and sort of the connections between all of our countries and the way our world is getting so much smaller. Recently, I was able to go to Serbia and Montenegro and advise the Montenegrins on sort of, I guess, what is sort of one of the final chapters of sort of the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. The Montenegrins are going to have a public referendum. You guys have probably heard of public referendums lately with the Iraq Constitution, where they're going to have a referendum and decide whether they want to withdraw from the country that is now Serbia and Montenegro, which was former Yugoslavia. And so that was, you know, that was the first time I was in the, you know, Eastern Europe, and so that was a wonderful, you know, experience. I'm also working with a wonderful man, the UN Special Rapporteur on Displaced Peoples, and he's writing a book about Africa and about the crises in Africa, particularly about minority groups and the identity crises that have resulted from constitutions that tend to impose models that don't always work with some of the people on the ground. And he has this theory that we've been working on, that if constitutions and legal frameworks better reflect the various traditions and values and customs of the people that it's actually going to govern, it therefore is more legitimate and therefore more effective. And so that's been an interesting experience as well. And then sort of most recently, I was able to go to Baghdad for about 3 weeks in July and to give technical advice and comparative constitutional analysis to the transitional government and the constitutional drafting committee. And I tell you all these things not to just run my resume through like, oh, wow, look at this. It's basically just tell you there are all these things that you can do with a career in law and in international law and in human rights and in politics and whatnot. And there is a place for all of us here, and there's a place for Latinos and Latinos in there, and we have a lot to say about that. I suppose some of you are interested a little bit in the Iraqi constitutional process, and I'll tell you just a little bit about that, and I'd be happy to answer more questions during the session or after in the hallways. The Iraqi constitutional process, basically what we did there is I went with the Public International Law and Policy Group, and they had been providing advice to the chair of the Constitutional Committee for some months before we went. And basically our job was really to be available to the committee members and to be available to the chair of the committee and the Iraqi legislator and other stakeholders, just to answer questions. Maybe there were questions about how do you establish a central bank? What would a constitutional provision look like? How should we deal with minority rights? Give us a comparative analysis of how we would establish a human rights commission. What should its functions be? How should its members be selected? Talk to us a little bit more about this word federalism. I'm sure you've all heard that a lot in the paper. What is federalism? You know, actually, about the last week we were there, the international experts started to say federalism was like the word we didn't speak about. Some people even called it the F word. You know, don't talk about it, because there was so much confusion about what federalism and self-government meant to different people. And as you know, so many people thought of federalism as sort of just absolutely tantamount to the breaking up of Iraq. It was a difficult concept to grapple with. So we did our best to provide as much advice as we can. It really wasn't, while we were there in July, it very much was an Iraqi-led process. They were drafting their constitution. They were brokering their political agreements. They were doing their work. I think the nature changed a tiny bit, of course, in August when the deadlines were getting tighter and Ambassador Khalisa from the U.S. and his team came down. And then there was a need to have those kinds of technical resources. I mean, I think the Iraqis were working under incredibly difficult circumstances. I recall so many times how they would say, well, thank you so much for, you know, coming to the green zone. You know, it's far from downtown Baghdad. The green zone is far from downtown Baghdad. And they would thank you. And I would think, wow, what an honor, please. I mean, the risk that these individuals were taking every day. I mean, countless times we sat next to people who you know, they had to hide their IDs just to come in and work with us. You know, they worked their other jobs at night, slept there, then came back to work with us. Even one day we had a meeting with some Iraqi legislators set up, and I recall that as we were waiting for them, we got a phone call from a colleague in the other building saying, well, I'm with them all now, but they just got a phone call that, you know, three Sunni legislators were just assassinated. And we said, well, are they still coming? And he said, well, the mood's more somber, but they're definitely still coming. And so for me, it's a demonstration of the incredible political will and political commitment and good faith that they had to this process of rule of law as opposed to violence. And so it was really a tremendous honor sort of to be there. I know that there is tremendous debate about sort of the value of the Constitution, as you all have been reading and whatnot. I think, you know, in terms of the way I see it, you know, I often say that the constitutional process itself is, it's really sort of a long distance run. It's really not a sprint, you know. We are just in the beginning sort of this political process that would be the race. And much of the value of the Iraqi Constitution, much of its potential is still yet to be seen. We have to see how it's implemented. We have to see how the enabling legislation is drafted, and we're playing a small part in that as well, the policy group. What will be its composition of its Human Rights Commission, of its constitutional court that will decide these issues, what are possible amendments, those kinds of things. And so there's still a lot yet to be determined there. My contact with people down there gives me a certain sense of hope, because I think there are some tremendous leaders down there who really want to move toward a strong political process. But it was a wonderful experience, and I think one of the things that I took the most from that is, you know, what they're trying to do, and I think what a lot of you have been talking about in your very other seminars, as we talk about minority rights and the rights of Latinos in this global community and in general, is that what we're really all working toward is sort of good governance. And I think a lot of what Iraq is struggling with right now, it's about good governance. However you define it, it could be defined differently to many people. I mean, to me, good governance, among other things, is it's about a government that's committed to the rule of law. It's about a government that protects fundamental freedoms and human rights. And it's a government that, yes, is a democracy, but as we know, democracy is more than just free elections. It's more than just the majority rules. It's about building a government that's inclusive and that's representative of all the components of the society, so that all of us, just like here in the United States, can see sort of a representation of ourselves in the government. And I think in many ways that's what Iraq is struggling with. In many ways that's what even here in the United States and in many other countries where we have such diverse ethnic populations, we're all sort of struggling for this, trying to find sort of that national identity of that country while still sort of making sure that we're preserving our different ethnic, you know, our ethnic, our religious and identities as well. I think I'll kind of, the only thing I thought I might want to do this time is maybe just give you just a couple of things of lessons learned. Just take two more minutes to do that. Lessons learned, not as much just from the legal, but more just sort of practical things maybe that people didn't tell me enough that I wish they kind of did when I was in law school. And I just kind of, things that I've learned over time. And I think the first thing I would tell you, no matter what work you choose to be in, whatever work you choose to be in, I think the first thing I would tell you above all is that your credibility and your integrity is your most valuable commodity. Your credibility, your integrity. It's your accuracy in your reporting. It's the trust that you build with your clients, with the other people that you work with. You lose that and you lose your ability to work effectively. So that is the biggest thing you could ever bring to the table, whether it's for your clients at a negotiating table, it's your credibility and your integrity. In this process of learning, I would also encourage you as well, to find some mentors. In every stage of my life, even now, I can think of people who mentored me, who taught me, who challenged me, and helped me to sort of navigate sort of professional, personal, ethical issues that you will have as you move through a career, if you're going to try to have a career that makes a difference and is an advanced career and is an engaged career. So find those mentors, find those people who believe in you. I'm not talking about those people who just give you gratuitous, oh, you're wonderful. People who know you and people who help kind of keep you centered when things get kind of out of hand, because there are those times when things do get out of hand. Definitely remember, you know, your compassion. I think that's something that is sort of really comes partly too from our culture, our ability to have compassion and to connect with people. And it's part of this idea of an extended family that as Latinos we're so accustomed to. I think that that's something, once you find that you seem to be losing that, take a vacation because you need one. I'd also say get a Rolodex or whatever other electronic method you have. Trust in the relationships you build. It's extremely important that as you begin your career, everybody you meet is important. Everyone you meet is important. If knowledge is power and power is capacity, then all those people you know, that means you're one or two phone calls away from knowledge and power. And so every one of those contacts you make, write them down and hold on to them, because you will go back to them. I'd also encourage you to do things that scare you to death. If one day you're sitting on the couch and someone's giving you an opportunity and you're saying, God, that voice inside you saying, that's really scary, I don't think I'm up to the challenge, that's when you have to do it, because it usually means that something's more important than your fear, and that's when you're going to have the most wonderful experiences. So I encourage you to do that. I would also tell you to always remember that your best solutions are probably those that come from the bottom up. And what that means is that when you're working with your clients, when you're working with grassroots organizations, communities on the ground, the best solutions are going to be the ones that come from them, the ones that they develop, the ones that they own, the ones that they're going to manage. Those will be the most effective solutions. Also, when you have good solutions, don't try to own those. That would be my another thing of advice. In fact, the best thing you could do at a negotiation is make the other person think your great idea is theirs. Okay? So don't own good ideas. Don't own good ideas. Share them. Lastly, I would just tell you, I'd like to follow with what Dean Claudio Grossman said, is really embrace your culture and use it to your advantage. And it's language, and it's about, you know, when I think of my Latino culture and I think about my family, my extended family, everybody's extended family. I'm sure we can all relate to having number of parties with family. And how many times did you ask your mother, father, who's that woman in the corner? And they say, oh, don't worry about it. She's family. Go kiss her, right? She's family. Go kiss her. That's part of kind of who we are. Certainly working in the Americas, we do a lot of kissing at meetings. Hello, hello, hello. I had to really kind of pull that back when I went to the Middle East. You don't go around kissing every Iraqi legislator you meet. It's not a good thing to do. But with that said, that, you know, my Latino culture, I did bring, for instance, to the Middle East. You know, I remember this one woman every day, at least three times a day, she'd pat me down, do a security check. Finally, after about 5 or 6 days, you know, I said, with these very intimate, you know, exchanges, I said, you know, and I found out how to say, you know, what's your name, you know, and we exchanged names. And then as she's looking through my bag, she saw a picture of my family of 25 people that I happened to have in a particular photo. And with our broken exchanges, you know, she understood this was my family. Because in the end, that was what it was about for them. It was about protecting their family and their culture and their values and whatnot. And so I just say embrace that Latina culture and those kinds of relationships and the way that you deal with people and the way that you connect with people and that way that you relate. Because it is something that is worthy of holding on to and bringing to your job. And it's a real asset. Well, I think I've spoken enough, and I'll answer any questions. And also, I also encourage you, if you ever have any questions or want any help or want to chat or whatnot, my name is with the conference center, and you guys are welcome to call me or email me or ask me for it later. I'd be happy to offer whatever little advice or guidance I can give at this early stage. Thank you very much.
Mrs. Jimenez. I think we have a very good notion of the very important role Latinos have been playing in the global networking. And probably you have some questions to the panelists. And please, you can go to the microphone and make the questions. Or if you prefer, you can raise the questions.
Can I just say something, sir? What is his name?
Alcil.
Okay. I just wanted to say something I think that might bring a little bit, little of this stuff, because it's like blah, 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 right? Into the in concrete world that we live in. There is, and it all, I think it connects a lot of the stories that have been told. I'll give you an example. I've been involved for the last 10 or so years with the rights of Haitian people in the Dominican Republic. I guess I'm boring you guys. I'm sorry. Bye.
Ah, entiendo. From my office that I have to
okay. Wait. Have fun.
Okay.
The case of the Haitian Dominicans, of people of Haitian descent in the Dominican Republic, was before the Inter-American Court various times. As of a month or so ago, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this story. This story is about 500 years old. There have been people of Haitian descent living in the Dominican Republic for forever, but they had been systematic disenfranchisement of those people based on historical questions of xenophobia and racism. Okay? In the Dominican Republic, a couple of us took the case to the Inter-American Court and won. The national rights for those individuals, those people of Haitian Dominican descent that were born in the Dominican Republic, were guaranteed, according to the Inter-American Court, the right to be Dominican nationals, just like anybody else who was born in the country. How did we win? I mean, we won because the court said we won. We also staged a tremendous campaign in New York City, where there are close to 800,000 Dominicans and people of Dominican descent. We went to Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, and told them, look, this is happening in the Dominican Republic. It seems like far away. The president of the Dominican Republic comes here to beg for money. Whenever he comes here, we want you to tell him that this is a problem. Okay? We organized the Dominican community in New York City for when the Dominican president came to New York City. We staged protests. We spoke to him. We told him this is a major problem, and we're not going to stand for it because we are migrants ourselves in the U.S., and you cannot have a double standard for people in the Dominican Republic. It's hypocrisy. Okay? So we passed a resolution in the New York City Council to post the same idea. And so all these different things we did out of New York, okay? But the court is in Costa Rica, and it's the Inter-American Court, and the issue is in the Dominican Republic. The point of this whole story is to say that there are a lot of things going on here within the Inter-American laws and resolutions and things that seem far, far away from real people. But what connects it all and what can actually generate real change is if we mobilize here our people resources to instigate and force, really, hold accountable the governments in these foreign countries where our parents come from, where I'm from the Dominican Republic. My mother sends I send so much money over there, the least they can do is have basic human rights, right? So, I mean, we cannot just, not to pick on you, we cannot just build, latrines in foreign countries. We have to also hold them accountable for basic human protections. And so what that means is using the resources that we have here, okay, our access to politics, to the New York Times, to the Washington Post, to pick on these governments so they improve the way they treat people.
Hi, my name is Manny Alvarez. I'm from Hastings in San Francisco, and I had a question for Ms. Jimenez. We read about the sorts of power struggles that the Muslim factions are having over the draft and the Constitution. And I was wondering, if possible, if you could speak generally about the advice that your group has given to the committee about that.
About sort of the kind of the differences between the ethnic groups and the religious differences and those kinds of things. Well, I think, you know, one of the things that, first of all, in an environment like that, you know, you always have to assess sort of what it is you're being called to do. In that particular environment, when we were called down to Iraq, not quite the same environment as if, let's say, I was working with Human Rights Watch again or whatnot. You had to be a little bit more delicate in terms of the kinds of advice that we did give. Why? Because we were sort of supposed to be impartial international experts giving comparative analysis. So, you know, you need to be very careful about certain issues, and certainly issues regarding like Islam and women's rights. While certainly we touched on those, you had to be very careful of the ways and the creative ways that you approach those. You might see some language and you think, yeah, and you would say, well, another way to write that might be, you know, or this language might expose you to some international scrutiny, so you might want to go with this formulation. In large part, I think what you're seeing when you're talking about this sort of the ethnic and sectarian divisions, you know, what happened in the end is that the Constitution really is sort of this delicate balance between sort of this promise of a democratic future, balanced with sort of these historical traditions of Islam that do represent values of a large majority of the population. And, you know, I mean, 80% are, as you know, 80% are Muslim, and so you do have to respect those traditions. And the Constitution really wouldn't be legitimate if it didn't in some way reflect that. The question was how. You know, the question is how that would come about. Also, the same thing in terms of minority rights. You know, it's a very diverse community. You know, we often see Kurds and we see Sunnis and we see Shias, but they're really not as homogeneous as that. You also have 5% of a Christian community. You also have the Arabs versus non-Arab ideas, Shiites versus Sunni Muslims. It's a lot more of diversity, and that's why I mentioned to you this idea of needing to build sort of some form of national identity so that loyalties to clans and tribes and groups are transcended to some extent. Not erased, you know, that would be wrong too, but somehow transcended. And part of how we would advise things to do that, certainly through the federal structure where you decentralize and provide more self-governance, bringing power closer to local populations so there could be some kind of accommodation for diversities in the different region. Certainly recommending strong minority rights regimes, minority rights that protect religious freedoms, which I do believe the Constitution has a number of articles that protects religious freedoms, and certainly those were things that ourselves as well as other international experts and people on the ground, Iraqis themselves. It wasn't Iraqi-driven process that we encouraged them to ensure that there were religious freedoms, that there were minority rights regimes that protected minority languages, minority cultures, minority institutions, minority religions and cultures. All of that trying to build some kind of a framework where everybody was represented in the government, but everybody was allowed to sort of also still express who they were.
If you wish, you can raise your questions from your seats. It's not necessary to go to, because I think you can hear.
I just have a question. Because of the topic of the panel today, as a student who's always been interested in international human rights and going into the law school setting, I think Dean Grossman kind of touched on this, that law school really isn't made for that person, or at least not yet anyways. I feel as though, I mean, I have to preempt that, I guess, a little bit by saying it is and it isn't. And I feel like the curriculum that's mandated, you know, for first-year students sometimes doesn't encompass that vision within it, and I know that it's changing, and that some schools have more curriculums than others that are kind of more in line with that kind of vision. So do you see a change within our, you know, legal community in terms of trying to change that more actively rather than passively allowing it to change only with global conditions changing? And if so, can you explain a little bit about how you personally feel about those issues, and if you also are actively participating in doing something about that, so that we can represent ourselves as Latinos within our own community from the get-go, from the legal education standpoint. Thank you.
You asking anyone?
Please.
Oh, okay. I think you just finished your first year, is that? Okay. I don't know what the curricula looks like here. I think generally, I can tell you this with all frankness, lawyering is one of the most antiquated teachings in the universe. I think we are really, really behind in terms of how things really get done and how what our role in society truly is, which is to be problem solvers, not to be instigators of fights. And I think that's what a lot of these schools teach us. And we get out there to the real world and find out that, wait a minute, what was that all about? I spent, you know, a lot of money, $100,000, and then you have to take out loans to take the bar on top, to really not know what is going on. And so I'm the last person to ask this question of, because I have a real problem with the profession as it stands in the way that it teaches us to be experts and not really engage other people as equals. One. Two, in terms of the international and the not even just international, just basic pragmatic practice of problem solving in daily routine. And you don't have to, I work at an international, humongous international law firm in New York, practice antitrust law, in case you're wondering, what the hell does she do? I practice antitrust securities. I'm an organizer. I do human rights work. I do a bunch of different things. And the basic idea is that you have to be able to solve all those problems in this world. Everything from an economics problem to a question of, you know, human rights. And so the law school should teach you how to do that, and it doesn't. I don't know what to tell you. I think it basically has to come from the profession of change itself, because we're the least regulated profession, because the lawyers make the regulations, and why would we want to regulate ourselves? So it has to really be a movement within, and it comes a lot, to be honest, a lot of it comes from the professors, who are really, some of them, quite antiquated in their own social mannerisms, let alone their teaching habits.
I would just add to that. Yeah. I mean, I think I was lucky because I think here at American University, because it, you know, it is sort of one of the international human rights law schools, I didn't feel quite that. But I think one of the reasons why I chose to go to law school was that it wasn't just about the substance that I was teaching. I remember sitting in meetings at Human Rights Watch where they had I was a young associate then, just had senior research, and they'd be talking about an issue, whether it was in Colombia or mass graves in Guatemala, whatever it was, some kind of issue, and you'd see people on different sides, and you had people who had college degrees and master's degrees, and for some reason I always seemed to relate or was most persuaded when a lawyer would get up and give their argument, and I think, and this is in no way disparaging to the others, I mean, they were incredible people there, but there was something that appealed to me by the fact that I thought, if I go to law school, I'm going to find out how to reason through things. I'm going to find out, I'm going to be taught how to think critically, think out of the box, think about when I see something, arguing my side, arguing their side, seeing things from different angles. I like that sort of reasoning. And I felt like I did get that from law school. I mean, I'll never get back all those hours from law review that I don't feel taught me as much as I had hoped that they would. I'll never get back that time, ever. And I have a lot to say about law review, but I'll do that in private. but I did get sort of those reasonings. And I'm sure they're in many other institutions as well, and master's also for what I'm just saying that I felt that was one of the reasons why I went to law school. The other thing I would just say, if your law school isn't providing those, I would say is to get creative with your externships. I did that a lot too, because when I went to law school, I was very interested in indigenous rights, and I think we have one federal Indian law program. So what I just did was made sure when I did externships, I was kind of creative. So maybe that might be the only thing that you can do if your law school is sort of not helping you too much on that.
Hi, my name is Perla Sanchez. I'm from Golden Gate in San Francisco. And I know a lot of us are anxious to leave, but I think it's important to address this issue here. And I just want to ask, and I think it might be more specific to Mr. Quinones, but is anybody aware with the DREAM Act? And if so, what it is that you're doing? And I think this is very important because, one, I, for one, I'm an immigrant. I came here when I was 12 years old. And a lot of people that I know are here as immigrants for a generation. And in order for us to actually have change here for Latinos, we have to have Latinos representing us, you know, at this level. And if we're not helping our people here right now, then we can't expect change, really. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about the DREAM Act and if you know what it is, or otherwise I can, you know, say a little bit about it and how it is that you are educating people as well. Because I think it's very, very important not only to educate the layperson about it, but as in the legal profession as well.
Right. Thank you for that question. In fact, I know a lot about the DREAM Act. In my prior work with the Center for Community Change, I actually led a campaign called United We Dream, and it was an effort, it was a national effort trying to bring about, yeah? No, don't worry. I always kind of call it the DREAM Act, and it's a long name to remember. But in any case, the DREAM Act basically allows for students that came, you know, to the country undocumented, you know, out of as young children, allow them to actually go into college and pay in-state tuition. That's essentially what it does. And there's a pretty very big strong movement to try to get this legislation through Congress. And then the prior Congress, it actually made it through the Senate Judiciary Committee, but because of a lot of political wranglings and the election and whatnot, it never actually came to the Senate floor, nor did it move on the House side. And that is a big issue, and it's an issue that I am going to be addressing in the next couple of weeks, trying to pressure the Senate sponsors to actually sponsor it, because right now they have not sponsored it just yet. And last year it was Senator Hatch, Republican from Utah, and also Senator Durbin from Illinois. They were the two lead sponsors. But because of the current politics of immigration reform, they have held back and they haven't introduced it because they want to put pressure on trying to move a comprehensive immigration reform package rather than do it like a piecemeal basis. But what happened this past week, and I actually sent out an email about this, regarding the current immigration politics, is that the hard right, the anti-immigrant groups, are actually going on a piecemeal basis. They're actually trying to pass some bills that are going to be a lot more restrictive, a lot more punitive, and then they're actually going to lead to more massive deportations and whatnot. So given that, we're going to try to get our co-sponsors to actually introduce it so that way we can rally behind around it. That issue, I think, kind of, brings up the need, and I think, it was mentioned before that even the other two panelists, it was like, we have this vast, untapped political potential within Latinos right here and right now. And the only thing, and I'll say this last, the only thing that's keeping us from really realizing our own political power is ourselves. We need to start seeing that for ourselves, because once we start seeing us for really what truly what we are, then there won't be a scarcity of Latinos in the global arena. There won't be a scarcity of Latinos in the universities. There won't be a scarcity of Latinos in the political domestic side, because that's really our natural arena to play in. But it is us that are kind of keeping ourselves from that because of all the whatever hang-ups that we might have, from the past, either because your dad doesn't want to call you Jimenez or because of, and not to pick on your dad, but, for all those things, is that we need to start embracing ourselves really truly for what we are. And until then, and then we can start using the tools at our disposal today. And that is, the internet, technology, our culture and ability to communicate, our values, using that to try to move us forward and move, really truly, a concerted national movement. So, you know, again, the DREAM Act is important. I wanted to address it through as a BlueLatino.org sort of official campaign, and I definitely want to do that. But I think, you know, the bigger vision here is more than that, and that is really, you know, empowering ourselves to be full participants of this society. Why? Because this is our country, and the future is ours. And so we need to be prepared to actually lead it.
Hi. Good afternoon. It was a really interesting panel. But as I heard the panel, you all addressed very positive ways that Latinos can influence and should influence not only the politics of the United States, but a global politics, or at least a hemispheric politics. But I have a different kind of question, which is how, in your various opinions, you think those of us who are interested in that kind of positive change, mediating or addressing what I see as not an insignificant part of our community that I would not similarly characterize as interested in the kind of positive change that you've been describing. The current AG is one of the architects of a policy that many believe is not pro-human rights, and that's only one example, but perhaps the most visible and the one most publicly known by at least this group. And the legal profession is generally a conservative profession. So I'm interested to hear from your opinions, because you're all very involved and active in different ways, how you mediate perhaps that other part of what Latino lawyers and the Latino community might have an interest in that seems at odds with some of the change that you were suggesting that we could really influence.
That's a really deep and profound point. The point of the story is that there are some of us who basically the point is that just because you're Latino doesn't mean that you are the kindest person in the world automatically, nor that you automatically have the best interests of the poor in mind. And I think we are so blinded in this country by black and white issues because we're so obsessed with race and ethnicity. And we should be in certain respects, but we have to be a little bit more complex than simply looking at someone and based on his last name or what he looks like, that he automatically should be on my side. And so we have to, I'm more than anything, I'm not Latina, I'm not Dominican, I am from I'm a member of a marginalized community called the South Bronx. And to me, that means that in order for change to happen and real power to come for communities like that, and South Bronx is just representative of a whole lot of other communities, is that you're going to have to look at people, allies, who may not necessarily be of Dominican or Latino or whatever descent, and have similar values as yours. Class matters, people. Class ideology matters, sometimes more than race. And so we really have to be more critical of the way that politics is played in this country, whereby stamping somebody or having someone be of a certain origin automatically makes him or her your best friend. And we just have to be more critical.
Can I respond? Just 1 minute.
Thirty seconds
is that, you know, there are conservative Latinos and there are progressive Latinos. And then you have to focus on organizing the progressive ones. If you do that, and, you know, we're not a homogeneous community. We never have been. We never will be. So focus on those that, you know, do you have shared values? You can organize and build a political base from that. So that, you know, yeah, you're going to have a lot of conservatives, you know, wanting to claim that they're representing us as a community, but they're not. But if we don't focus and have a targeted approach, a targeted strategy of organizing our power, then we'll never, ever get to that point of, you know, of political power. So that's what we're called, blue Latinos, not red and blue. And this is not like all Latinos. No, it's just the progressive ones. That's all I care about.
Unfortunately, we have to finish. Thank you for panelists, and thank you, everybody. Okay. What? One moment.
Announcements.
Announcements?
Thank you. Another round of applause for our panelists, please. Fuerte, fuerte, que se oiga. Thank you, thank you. And panelists, please go. Yeah, okay, you guys are set. Thank you. But you can chill, hang out.